And today, well, we can talk, we're interested to talk about the work you've done in Costa Rica there with the plantations. And after that, to talk about some of the great lessons that you've learned in life that we can pass on to our future generations of foresters and things like this. And so yes, if we'd like to have a chat about all your experiences in Costa Rica, that would be really interesting.
I think... Well, I was not the founder of the Costa Rican activities. They were founded before I joined. And those who founded Pressuits started to plant mainly pochote, which was a genuine tree at that time. They regarded teak as more risky and said, well, pochote is genuine and will grow well. And it actually did grow well. They planted pochote. They experimented with different planting distances. 3 meters, 4 meters, 2 times 5.
All sorts of combinations.
But at the end, I think 3.5 times 3.5 or 3 times 3 was the mainly used planting distance then in our experience. We are now with cloned material, we are planting 375 with the idea that the final distance will be 750 and have about 150, 170 trees
at the end of the rotation.
Yes.
And how long is the rotation?
Well, for teak, we think that we can have a rotation between 12 and 18 years. In the beginning, we thought 25 to 30 years. Mm. But, and we will still let quite a part of the teak grow up to 30 years. To really see what makes the difference. Yeah, you know, the increase in diameter is after about the age of 15.
Right.
Slows down very much.
Mm-hmm.
So the additional volume will not pay off the longer rotation time.
Right.
Probably the quality of the timber will pay off.
Right.
But nobody knows.
You have to try. See
nobody,
what happens.
Nobody knows.
Mm.
And now the case of pochote, it was growing well, but now the big problem with pochote, you know, pochote is a semi-arid tree.
A local species there?
Yeah, local species, which grows typically where there is a dry season, loses its leaves during the dry season, and has a very valuable timber if it's hardwood. The problem now with pochote, which nobody knew, was that the process of getting hardwood and the change from sapwood to hardwood is very late.
Right. You have to grow a lot of sapwood before you get any heartwood.
Yes, and if you want to make thinnings with 8 or 10 years, it's almost only sepals, and has a very low value.
Right.
And that's actually the reason why nobody plants bocciotti anymore.
Right.
Because you would have to let it stand probably 30 to 50 years really to get the hardwood. And, oh yeah, die könntest du mir noch abbringen. And so, at the matter, nein, könntest du mir sie
abbringen.
Ja. So, actually, all the first year's plantations of bocciotti, they don't have value zero, but also much less than we thought at that time.
Mm.
So, teak is, in contrast, teak is a very good tree, grows very cylindric.
Yes.
You know, bocciotti also grows relative...
tapered. Quite a lot of taper.
Yeah, yes. And you have to debranch consequently, otherwise you get more a bush than a tree.
Right.
And teak is much better in this. And of course, 10 years old things of teak, you can sell
you
them.
You can sell them.
Easy.
In fact, I was talking to Felix from Precious Wood about that, about trying to help bring some of the Costa Rican teak of precious woods into the market in Vietnam for the garden furniture, which of course you can with the smaller lobes. You can even use the slats for the metal furniture with wood. So,
we have, I think, we have a Vietnamese client.
Right, yes.
In Costa Rica. So it is obvious today that you can base a business model so far only on teak in Central America. But Central America is very well adapted for teak. We plant only in the western side where there is a dry season. Teak also grows where it rains all the year, but and it even grows faster. But it is more exposed to illnesses, especially fungus.
Yes.
And we heard that some who planted in the Atlantic region have quite a problem with fungus.
Mm-hmm. In Indonesia, where they have planted for over 100 years a lot of teak, it's the same sort of problem. That much prefers the areas which are a bit drier and it grows very quickly on the volcanic soils where there's lots of rainfall, but it has a lot of problems too.
Yeah. And I think teak is also a mountain tree.
Right.
You should plant it where there is a certain...
Topography.
Which makes it a little bit more difficult to harvest and to work. But you cannot have it at a low cost.
That's right.
And we also made many experiences with other indigenous species.
Right.
With caoba, which is mahogany,
yes.
And many others. We planted about between 20 and 30 species. We planted at least 2 million indigenous trees.
Yep.
But after all, unfortunately, we must say that you can base a business case only on teak.
Right.
And I think everybody who wants to plant trees in Central America or in conditions which are similar like Central America, he should know that all the dreams about a mixed forest, an almost natural forest under economical criteria will not work, unfortunately.
It's a shame, yeah. It's always great if you can plant local species.
Yeah.
But sometimes it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
I saw a fantastic photo in your, excuse me, in your magazine, your booklet yesterday of the bare hillside some time ago, and then 10 years later with the teak. And, I mean, was that the condition of the land that you found when you got there? Was it generally completely deforested? And
it was mainly partly deforested, yes.
Got some great photos here.
Most of the land we planted on, we bought all the land. And it was normally agricultural land. I mean land for cattle raising before, the farmers didn't want to use anymore, because in Costa Rica there was a certain hype in cattle raising. Everybody thought
we could make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yep.
That was this idea that McDonald would consume illimited amounts.
Yes.
And then
did they do like in the Amazon, where they felled the natural forest and then grazed the cattle, or
yes, they did
a lot of that as well?
A lot of that. You know, Costa Rica had one of the highest deforestation rates until 1900 in the 70s.
Yes.
And then Costa Rica was one of the first countries to make the change and to give incentives for plantations and to start with a regulation of the use of natural forest. So you,
let me start. Go on.
These soils were very much in danger of drying out, of being eroded.
Especially on the hillsides, I guess.
Yes. And Costa Rica, you know, the places where we are, is hilly.
Yes.
Most is hilly.
So big problems for erosion.
Yeah. We care very much that, you know, there is a lot of being talked about monocultures.
Yes.
And I think, and is also a lot of discussions about species from abroad. Now, if you want to exclude species from abroad, from FSC, for instance, there will be almost no plantations, because
the local species just don't stack up economically.
At least in Central America. I can only speak about Central America.
Yeah.
And but in my eyes, one should be more strict about the question of the monoculture and the soil vegetation, because what you often see is that you see only teak trees, and no other, almost no...
Completely bare soil underneath.
Yeah, and this, well, at the end of the dry season, it might look
this
like
is normal,
this.
Yeah.
But normally, especially during the wet season, it should be a green carpet with many plants.
A lot of local diverse herbs and things like this.
Yes.
Yes.
Which is, gives also a home to many animals.
It protects the soil.
And protects the soil. and gives our biodiversity in the soil and above the soil.
Yeah, so these monoculture plantations that are planted so densely that nothing else can grow. Yeah, that doesn't sound like a good way to go, but it sounds like you guys have been very careful about making sure that you don't, when you see a tree crop, you don't just see the trees. You see what's underneath the trees and the whole biodiversity of the system.
I think this is essential. And the important question is to make the thinnings early enough.
Right. Keep the crown open, get the sunlight on the ground.
Yes, give some light.
Give some light, yeah.
This is essential. And the other essential point is that we never have big surfaces of only teak. We normally, our farms we bought were a mixture of pasture land, residual forests, single big trees, and we left all the residual forests, so we planted only in between.
No clearing.
And when there were, you know, sometimes we came to a case that quite a big surface was deforested by those who sold the farm to us.
Yeah.
And then we always plant islands of 200 trees with native species. So we plant a lot of those islands in between. We also plant some fruit trees for the animals. And I think if FSC goes on to formulate criteria for plantations which are good enough to be FSC certified, they should go more into this kind of criteria: soil vegetation, mosaic structure.
Mosaic structure, yeah.
As some content of indigenous trees, they cannot say or wait a third of the trees must be indigenous. That would make it economically not feasible. But a certain percentage can be asked in my eyes. And we think that FSC could have made a little bit more in defining criteria.
Right. They've got the plantations working working group. I know they've been working on these issues, but we haven't seen the report coming out of that yet, so we're not sure what the impact's going to be. But I know there's a lot of concern amongst NGOs about these vast, for example, the vast eucalyptus plantations in Brazil. I know that companies like Clubin have done a lot of the sort of things that you're talking about, where they've kept the mosaic of vegetation, the natural vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know those cases myself. I've not been there. But it sounds that, yes, I mean, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. You've got a completely bare ground. It's good to put trees back.
Yeah.
But if you're going to put them back, you need to be able to make some economic return from them.
Yeah.
But if you can make a mixture of the economic and the environmental and the social, which is the aspiration of FSC.
Yeah, you should find an equivalent between the economic and the ecological necessities.
One of the things I was going to ask you about, which we touched a little bit on last night after we'd had dinner when we weren't having our interview, is the relations, your relations with NGOs. And it's interesting for me because you and Precious Woods are clearly, you've embraced the concept of the FSC, and you've pursued the sustainable forest management. But you, at the end of the day, you know, you're working in Amazon rainforest, you're harvesting Amazon rainforest. Of course, a lot of NGOs disagree with that. But what you've done is you've brought a hard-nosed business sense to this, and I wonder if that's put you in the past in conflict with NGOs, where even though everyone says Precious Wood is great, look what they've done. At the end of the day, you're planting teak plantations, you're working in the Amazon, but you've come at it with this, look, we've got to be able to make money out of it as well. And I guess that sometimes that may put you at odds with some of the NGOs who have a vision of what things should be like, but you guys are out there in the forest, very practical, trying to make the business work. How have the relations been?
Well, you know, I think the NGOs have never been against plantations. They have probably been critical in some aspects, as we discussed, but normally they were okay. But when we started in Brazil with the management of existing forests, as well as WWF, as stronger, Greenpeace were totally against this. And well, WWF, with the creation of FSC, changed its attitude or its opinion,
yes,
and put in place clear criteria. And Greenpeace, we always invited Greenpeace, and they sent delegations of experts, looked at it, were satisfied. Then a bigger delegation came, and in 2001 we signed in the Amazon a sort of a paper that Greenpeace acknowledges that the example of Precious Woods Amazon as a good example.
Brilliant.
That this is sort of a gold standard how it should be done. Of course, at that time the technical aspects that the forest remains a forest was the key issue.
Right.
The social issues were not as important, but as I told you yesterday, we have no concessions and we have nobody living in the forest, so the social question was never as important there. And since then, we have in Brazil, between Greenpeace and Precious Woods, a very good relationship.
Right.
And Greenpeace Brazil is very much on our line. Very much. Unfortunately, many people some people of Greenpeace International did actually never make this step. They still think that the chainsaw is the biggest enemy of the forest. They don't see that it is the cattle and the soybean. they still think it's the timber trader who destroys the forest.
Are you finding more conflict with the NGOs now that you've moved into the African context, into the Congo?
Well, of course, especially with Greenpeace. They are in Africa, or the African team is very ideological, as I perceived it, and they are totally against, as I perceive it, they are actually totally against organized forestry.
Hmm.
And in my eyes, they totally misunderstand the situation. But let me go one page before. In 2002, when we went to the stock exchange, when we were quoted, I went before the press myself, at my left, the chief forestry campaigner of WWF Switzerland, and at my right, the chief forestry campaigner of Greenpeace Switzerland.
Is that Christoph Widmer?
Christoph Widmer, yeah.
I know Christoph from the work in CIB.
Yeah, know Christoph. He is the one with whom I had the most contact. He is not with Greenpeace anymore,
right,
which is, in my eyes, typical, that Greenpeace always has new young people, and as soon as they really get some expertise and understand, they don't feel comfortable anymore in this ideological surrounding, and they often go to other organizations or to state organizations. Or
it must have been very powerful for you to go to with WWF and Greenpeace, saying that what you were doing was a great thing. It must have supported the listing very strongly.
Well, I don't know exactly. At least from the value, the symbolic value was high. Whether it has motivated shareholders to buy shares, there's few people who buy shares who listen very much to Greenpeace.
I guess that was early on, in a few years ago. Before, I think this concept of ethical investing is becoming stronger now.
Yeah.
So perhaps if you did it today, it might have a bigger impact.
Maybe, yes.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, today we, in about the African subject, we disagree quite with these people from Amsterdam, It's.
I guess they're concerned about the concession licenses and the legality of these things, and it's been a long time with the review of that.
Most of these people, I've been together with them for hours, have spent not more than 3 days in tropical forests in their life. They have spent a few days or a few weeks in Africa. There are some exceptions who really have experience, but many of them just want to confirm their prejudices and don't really look for the truth. You know what we have in Congo, for instance? Organized for forestry in the Democratic Republic of Congo is so small.
Tiny, yes.
It's almost nothing. It can have almost no impact. And still they say, organized forestry is capable for the reduction of the fauna, of the poverty of the people, of the destruction of the forest, etc., etc. But I think for energy wood, about 500 times as much
huge
timber is being cut
for the charcoal
than for export.
Yeah.
So it is, but it seems they don't want to search the truth. They just want to confirm their prejudices. Unfortunately, because they could make good contributions out of their point of view.
Hopefully in time.
Yeah.
Hopefully in time. I think now that this review is done with the World Bank and concession licenses are being verified or taken away, once hopefully that's clear, then some of the leading companies can pursue FSC and set an example down there. I know everyone's concerned about the land use. Should it be in protection? Should it be in production zones and things like that? But hopefully through the FSC process, the really high value forests can be put aside for conservation, and the other production forests can be logged in a sustainable way. They need an example like precious woods, perhaps. Of course, over the river we have CIB who are doing doing good work, and now we have Rougier and CEB in Gabon as great examples. So I think we're starting to get some good examples now. And I think it's really there is an opportunity for the FSC to really set a high standard in Africa.
So, in general, we regarded the NGOs always as people within our boat, and that there were few exceptions where we had the impression not to sit in the same boat. I'm also a member of WWF for decades, and I am regular donator for Greenpeace for many years. I was always, I come from this
background.
I know Greenpeace for, in many cases, I know Greenpeace for more years than the activists in Amsterdam.
Yes. Probably for more years than some of them have been alive, perhaps. Yes.
Of course.
They play a good role in raising awareness, and I think that's important. And I guess your past experience with resolving conflicts and in the cooperative situations, this has been really helpful for you in these processes.
I think also this will probably change when once I'm not here anymore. As a person, I was always respected. Also now with some people of Greenpeace who are ideologically totally different from our point of view, they say, well, Andres, you personally, we respect you fully, 100%. But we disagree with this or this. As a person, I think, almost always respected very well. Because, it was difficult to attack me because I was a member of the Green Movement for more years than most of them. So how should they attack me?
Yeah, you just had a different approach.
Yeah.
You came at it from a conservation perspective, but looking at the role of business.
I was also a socialist member of the parliament in 1976 to 1978, where it was difficult to be a socialist in this surrounding where we live here, which is a very, very conservative one.
Mm.
So I have been fighting many things which some of the young people were still children.
Yes. Am I right to say you're president of the Precious Woods Board?
Or yes.
Yes.
So since 1970.
So, a great role, and I mean, just looking back, we talked yesterday about the challenges that Precious Wood faced in its early years. But I mean, what would you say were the key moments, the biggest challenges, the biggest? What's the future really for a company like Precious Woods in the world today?
Well, I think the African challenges is very big at the moment. Because if you want to have a certain impact on forestry, tropical forestry in this world, you cannot leave the Congo Basin away. And if you consider the Congo Basin, you cannot leave the Democratic Republic.
It's a big area.
And this is the most difficult country, but it's the key country. I mean, you can work in Gabon, or you can work in the central. Yes, but yes. You will always stay at the periphery. That the center is clearly the
DRC,
and this is, of course, outstandingly difficult.
Yeah. Precious woods.
But there is also other challenges, like in Peru or Bolivia, Guinea, and other places in Brazil. I think there is a lot to do for precious woods. There is a lot of space to develop.
Yeah, I mean, the world's forests, we've been talking about the disappearance of the world's forests for as long as I have been involved in forestry, which is a couple of decades. But it does seem now, with the expansion of soy and oil palm and these things, that we really are in a bit of a difficult time. And sustainable forest management, to me, has a great role to play in trying to stop this forest frontier. But it's got to pay. It's got to pay more than clearing land for soy. A lot of people are looking for carbon, payments for carbon, to help add value to sustainable forest management. And I know you've gone down that road in precious woods. Can you tell us a bit about that, Andres?
Well, as a matter of fact, we only collected money for the carbon in the context with our electro planting, where we burn the
sawmill waste,
the waste wood or the rest wood, and this is an important income for us. And we also have, for the plantations in Central America, as long as they are growing. You know, for a plantation, you absorb carbon only during the growth phase. Once it is established and you harvest and replant regularly, it will stay
equilibrium.
Yeah. But in a certain phases, you can claim that you absorb carbon dioxide, and we got some money from the not from Kyoto
voluntary market,
voluntary, like the Chicago
exchange.
And of course we are now talking about the first projects of avoided deforestation.
Right.
And this is the next big challenge, to whether this will be acknowledged by the other stakeholders, that they say, yes, that's true, making sustainable forestry really avoids deforestation. You know, we had also some illusions in Brazil. In Pará, we hoped by establishing our project really to protect the forest. But we were invaded by illegal settlers and illegal loggers, and because we are not armed and we do not defend us with arms, we could actually not do a lot about. So that was one probably of the disillusions for me, that our that the institutions in Brazil were not strong enough and were not willing enough to defend our way of land use against the illegal invaders.
Mm.
And that's one of the deceptions we lived in Brazil. But you know, in Brazil you always have the laws, and then you have really those who have the power, and there is so many people depending on illegal logging and settling that it is, in theory, everything is clear, but in practically
it's a big mess.
It's difficult, still difficult.
Mm. And your hopes, what are your hopes for the future out there? I mean, is Precious Woods looking to get more forest? And
yes, as I said, you know, one, of course, is the big African challenge, but there are other countries like in South America. We have left Asia away for ourselves so far, but I wouldn't exclude that forever and always.
Sure.